time we got going on this.
I'd like to call to order this hearing on the Committee on State and Local Government Operations and Oversight. We are having a series of hearings through the interim on areas over which this committee does indeed have oversight, and trying to make ourselves more familiar with the workings of the, in this instance, the number of councils that are under the jurisdiction of this committee on a policy basis. And, of course, Senator Betzel, who chairs the Finance Division, has his committee on which I sit, and Senator Vickerman has jurisdiction over any kind of appropriation that supports the work of this group. I would like members to introduce themselves so that the members of the audience and the people who are going to be testifying know who you are and where you're from. And I am Ann Rest, and chair this committee, and am state senator from District 45, which is the western suburbs of Hennepin County, New Hope, Crystal, Golden, parts of Golden Valley, part of Plymouth, and Robbinsdale. Senator Vickerman, if you would introduce yourself.
I'm State Senator Jim Vickerman. I represent southwestern Minnesota, six counties in the corner of the state. They have a lot of minorities have moved in, a lot of immigrants have moved in. We have a couple of casinos that are very close. I'm very interested in seeing that everybody gets treated fair and equally.
And Senator Vickerman, you chair the
committee. Veterans in the Ag and
Veterans and Ag Finance.
Finance. Budget Division.
And
Budget
Policy.
Division and the Policy Division. Senator Laurie is the vice chair of this committee. Senator Laurie, if you'd introduce yourself.
Yes, Senator Laurie from Senate District 8, which is most of the I-35 corridor between the Twin Cities and Duluth, not including either the Twin Cities and Duluth, of course, a very rural and low-income district. Very glad to be here today. I also serve on Senator Vickerman's Ag and Vet Policy Committee, and looking forward to a good afternoon of testimony.
And Senator Laurie was the author of a bill.
The restructuring of the Indian Affairs Council.
That was, and we are going to be hearing from them first. And
yes.
So interested to see how they are reacting to the new law and their new membership. to my left is Peter Bricquetti, who is the legislative assistant for the committee. To my right is Brenda Schaefer-Pellinen, who is the committee administrator. And to her right is Senator Torres Ray, who we invited to be here today, although she is not a member of the committee. Senator Torres Ray, if you'd introduce yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing me to be part of this committee. I'm very interested in the work that the councils do, and I have contacted Senator Rest to see if I could participate in this hearing because I would like to continue to work with you in the future. I represent District 62, which is southeast Minneapolis. Thank you.
And I'm Tom
Bodder. Next to her.
I'm the Senate counsel for the State Government Policy Committee and for the Budget Division as well.
And Senator Betzold?
I'm Don Betzold, State Senator, District 51, which includes part of Fridley, Moundsview, Spring Lake Park, and Blaine in the northern Minneapolis suburban area.
And again, he chairs the State Government Finance Budget Division. Senator Loring, Roebling, we are just introducing ourselves so that our guests know who we are and where our districts are.
Okay. I'm Senator Claire Roebling, and I represent Scott County, Shakopee, Prior Lake, Jordan, Savage, Newmarket, Elko area.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Larson. I'm the state senator for all of Richfield, of portions of Bloomington and South Minneapolis.
Thank you. Senator Betzold and I also serve on the Sesquicentennial Commission, which is a group appointed by both the governor and the legislature to make the arrangements for the commemoration of Minnesota's anniversary of it becoming a state, which will occur next year. And I invited Jane Leonard, who is the executive director of the Sesquicentennial Commission, to come and just speak briefly about it. And Aretha Clark King, who is the vice chair of the commission, is also present, along with a couple of their interns and staff, to actually issue a formal invitation to the councils who will be presenting here today to become part of and partners with the commission in discerning what the really appropriate ways are for you folks to be involved in the activities next year. So we'll just begin with that for just a couple of minutes. Ms. Leonard, Ms. King, if you'd like to come forward, that would be fine. And whatever props you want to bring, that's okay too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Some more. The locals are going around. Should I begin here?
And you need to identify yourself, please, for the records.
Well, I'm Aretha Clark King, Vice Chair of the Sesquicentennial Commission, and I am delighted to be here. First of all, Senator Ressa, we could issue an invitation for the councils to work with us. My first item on my agenda is to thank all of you for your interest and for allowing us the time to come today to just tell you more about the commission, the direction we are moving in, and also certainly to extend an enthusiastic welcome to the council, to the councils, to participate with us and in a very engaging way. I might put them on notice that we have been talking about them, so their ears must have been burning, but we've been hopeful that you will take a strong interest in the commission's work and in this celebration of the history of our great state. And we are just all gung-ho about it. I am personally. I think all of us can say we are what they call raving fans of Minnesota. And this 150th anniversary of statehood will be a time to celebrate why we are such great fans of our state. So as vice chair of the commission, I can just say to you over and over again how pleased we are about your support and your interest, and I think we will pledge to make you very proud of the celebration to come. And I want to thank Senator Rest, Senator Bessel, and other senators who are members of our commission. They are hardworking, and we novices, lay people in government, are learning a lot from them. And it's just a great story. I would like to turn now to our wonderful and hardworking executive director of the commission, Jane Leonard, who will give you more of the meat of what we are doing in the commission. But I would say that you're going to hear much more from us, and we're just so enthusiastic, and we hope you will be too.
Ms. Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm Jane Leonard, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sesquicentennial Commission, and very proud to serve with both Senator Rest and Senator Betzhold and Dr. King here, too.
And I might mention that the other two senators on the commission are Senator Pariseau and Senator Olson, and one of the governor's appointees is former Senator Cal Larson.
And just in real quickly, because I know you've got a lot of people to get through, just wanted to again extend our sincerest invitation to participate and help us. We really want to make sure that this sesquicentennial represents all of what Minnesota is and is going to be, and so we need your help. And we will be following up with each of you to set up meetings and see how you can help us and we can help you. As Dr. King said, this is a big celebration for Minnesota. We also want to commemorate the history that we've had And we see it as a catalyst, really, as well, to look to the future and see what is ahead and how we can better prepare for that. I do want to invite you also to take a look at our website. And Eric Anobi here is one of our sesquicentennial fellows, and he's holding up the banner, which on the very bottom says mn150years.org. That's our website. Mm-hmm. We do have a grant program that is just underway, thanks to the efforts of the legislature and the governor. And the first deadline for the micro-grants, which is up to $1,000 each, is August 15th. And then there's a legacy grant program, which I believe the deadline is September 15th. But there will be two rounds, so don't worry, there's still time. But please go to our website and take a look at that. We also wanted to just alert you to the weekend festival. As Senator Russ said, May 11th next year is the Statehood Day. And if you get a chance to look out on the Capitol grounds, that's where we hope to be with great weather, not as hot as today, in May that weekend. And so, again, we want to invite everybody to participate, and we will be in touch with everybody to see how they would like to participate. There also will be a sesquicentennial commemorative stamp coming out for the 150th anniversary. Much of that is due to the work of Dr. King, and that will be unveiled, we hope, in October of this year and then issued on May 11th of next year. We are also doing a sesquicentennial plan for the future, of which Senator Rest is a co-chair, along with Representative Maury Lanning from the Moorhead area. And this is our attempt to capture what Minnesotans are thinking right now and looking towards in the future. And so, again, we're trying to capture as much of the sense of need and challenge ahead, and then ways that we can meet that demanding future. The Sesquicentennial Fellows is a way that we're getting young college students and others involved, and Tane Danger and Eric here are just two of 6 to 8 fellows that we have. And then many partnerships with organizations like the Minnesota Historical Society, the University of Minnesota, and the Minnesota State College and University System. So those are our major partners, but we also want to partner with every local government, every organization possible under the sun, and we're really grateful to your committee, Madam Chair, to let us have this opportunity to make that pledge and invitation and plea for help. So,
and I want to make it clear that Ms. Leonard's invitation is to the representatives of the councils who are going to be speaking to us today, not an invitation to the legislature, because we're already involved. Yeah. So we wanted to make sure that when the leaders of the various councils get a call from Ms. Leonard or Ms. King, or our chair, who is Keshe Hillervik, that you can put a face with the voice on the telephone, asking you folks to consider ways in which you might like to help in this commemoration, reflection on the history of Minnesota, not all of which, of course, were happy times for members of the communities that are represented today, but we want it to be meaningful and respectful, and you folks are the people who can make sure that that happens next year. So thank you very much, Ms. Leonard, Ms. King, Mr. Danger.
Madam Chair, I should know, I serve on the Budget Committee. What kind of money did they get money in this last legislative process?
Yes. I was disappointed that the governor's request was not fully funded, which was $2 million, but we did have, we ended up with $750,000, and what the commission is doing is taking, really trying to have a statewide effort, and in some communities it really doesn't take a whole lot of money to get the community involved, but it does take some. So we have these, what she referred to, these micro grants of $1,000, and the budget includes how many of those at this
150
point?
Micro grants.
Yeah,
and
so it'll be 150 $1,000 grants for someone in the community to maybe sponsor a a get-together, to have a picnic, to have a speaker, to have a display at their county historical society. And we're trying to make sure that statehood is commemorated in every county, at least in every county in the state, and as many communities as possible.
Well, Madam Chair, I raise that question because I'm going to be dedicating Murray County's 150 years to July 28th.
This year.
I'll put the good word out.
Good. Yeah. Well, maybe Ms. Leonard will contact you, too, to have some statehood celebration materials available for you. And you each should have received the button that is part of that celebration, and we hope that you will take one. Mr. Danger has them there. And get one if you don't already have them.
Madam Chair, could I just make reference to Senator Vickerman's comment? We do have an events calendar, and we're trying to serve as a clearinghouse, so any existing events like a Murray County sesquicentennial or Cinco de Mayo or, you know, whatever festivals are out there, we would love to have those on the calendar, both right now and for 2008. So we just would, as Senator Ress said, we'd invite everyone here to help populate that calendar and help commemorate this really auspicious event in our history. So,
mm-hmm. Any other comments? And thank you very much, Ms. King. Ms. Leonard, we appreciate your taking the time to be here with us this afternoon, and to the Sesquicentennial Fellows. We're going to begin the substance of today's hearing with having a presentation from the members who are present of the Indian Affairs Council. We asked each of you, and you were very gracious in your meetings with Mr. Bricwedy, to give us some information, more background than we had in very brief oversight hearings during the session, a little bit more time to have a conversation, to get to know your work, if you have annual reports to ask you that you bring them, what kinds of plans you have for the future of your council, how can the legislature become more involved in understanding what your work is and what your mission is. And in particular, we had, and this is probably more appropriate for some of the councils than others, but we had task force legislation as part of the state government bill establishing a commission on new Americans and a commission on ethnic heritage. In our conference committee report, those two were combined. Subsequently, in the governor's veto message of that bill, he indicated that he thought a number of the mission objectives that were in that legislation could be accomplished by existing councils of color. So that was a question that we asked as well. And subsequent to that, the Legislative Coordinating Commission has taken on itself to appoint or asked to be appointed, it has not been appointed yet, a working group under its auspices where it will be appointing legislative members to deal with the issues that were raised in as part of the charge to that commission. So we hope that when that is appointed, that they will reach out to all of you, because it's not just new Americans, but it is on the ethnic heritage of our state as well, as we look to ways in which to really encourage and recognize the, in particular, the economic and cultural contributions of various groups that make up who we are as Minnesotans. So If you want to speak about that, that's fine too. So we would like to begin with the Indian Affairs Committee, Council. I'm sorry, this is the group. They would come forward that Senator Lori had some reconstituting language for how this group operates, and I hope that you might begin with well, you can begin any way you want, but I certainly hope you will talk to us about your new structure and how you think that's going to work and what opportunities you see there. So welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rest, members of the committee. My name is Anna Marie Hill, and I am the current executive director of the Indian Affairs Council, and with me are two of my staff, and three out of the four staff in entirety, and I'll let them introduce themselves. So,
good afternoon. My name is Jim Jones. I'm the Culture Resource Director for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council.
Mr. Jones, welcome.
And I'm Jolene Shoptees, Communications and Legislative Director.
Ms. Shoptees, thank you very much.
Again, thanks for having us. I do want to say right away I am an enrolled member of the Red Lake Band of Chippewa Indians. And I am finishing my first year. I just recently finished my first year as executive director for the Indian Affairs Council. And I think that we had a wonderful year, and I want to thank all of you for supporting us in many different ways legislatively here at the Capitol. There was just an overwhelming amount of support, and we got a lot of work done. We did our best as an office. Our official duties are as liaison between the tribes and the state of Minnesota, legislators, commissioners, state offices. And we did our best to communicate back and forth and let you know what we needed in every respect. And it was just, it was a wonderful year. So we really do thank you wholeheartedly. Already mentioned was our restructure bill, which was an entire restructure of Minnesota statutes, section 3.922. And that is the statute that governs the Indian Affairs Council. The Indian Affairs Council is the oldest council in the state of Minnesota. And as a matter of fact, we're the first council ever for Indian Affairs in the entire nation. So we are a precedented council. And we are looked at as a leader, per se, and we are definitely committed to keeping that reputation going. And we are probably the largest with regards to the board composition. I always forget how many people we have on the board. And we currently have, in my calculated counting, 28 members of the board. The restructure did make some changes to our working board, considering it put in place everybody is considered a board member, and we aren't designating individuals as ex officios anymore, so we aren't making that difference. The voting membership remains as the 11 tribal representatives through the state of Minnesota. I should say that in case any of you go, well, who are they? We did provide you with a handout that you have. It is an up-to-date handout, and it has every single chair and every single reservation listed in that handout. It's a very good tool for you to hang on to and just to refer to as you are also picking up the phone and calling us and saying, you know, who do I talk to or who do I get a hold of for this issue? So the board membership on the restructure bill still, the voting membership still remains the same. It will be the 11 members of the reservations if a vote is taken. Now, the restructure, the primary purpose of the restructure was to work in a more accurate government-to-government relationship that has always been maintained in the state of Minnesota since the beginning of the state of Minnesota. We are sovereign nations. And I know that word has often scared people and alarmed people, and I certainly understand that because I, too, went through the school system in Minnesota, and we did not have enough education and learning, and we still don't to this day, providing correct information. So that's why people get scared. They don't know what that means when you're dealing with a sovereign entity. And there's all the whys and how comes that come along with that. But the restructure bill did a tremendous job at putting that relation, establishing that relationship more clearly in the working construct of the board. So what that means is it eliminated some critical language that had mandated our tribal chairs to sit on the board of the Indian Affairs Council. And as we all know, since 1963, there have been a lot of changes with regards to the relationship with the tribes in the state. In 1963, we really were economically undeveloped. And this was a situation where the state of Minnesota got the people together and they, you know, were wanting and searching for ways to help the tribes really move forward from a very, very impoverished situation. And we are making strides, as you all know, but still we do remain in critical situations with high rates of unemployment on many reservations that are still economically disadvantaged and still in a situation that's very dire in comparison to what the rest of the state of Minnesota does enjoy. But that so what we did, and I think the major highlight of the restructure bill is to remove that mandate to have the tribal chairs sitting on the board, and they are now able to appoint members to the board who will come and represent the tribal chairs and the tribal council and to get the business done on the council that needs to continue being done. The government-to-government dialogue, such as you and I would have in the room, what are we going to work on with regards to Indian issues in the state of Minnesota? These issues remain. I know there's a whole lot of people who don't want them to remain, but they do remain. So that is where we are with the restructure bill. It's effective because there is no appropriation. It's effective August 1st. And so we have our final meeting of the old board July 31st, and you certainly are all welcome to come. It's up in Fortune Bay. And we're going to be discussing just exactly how we are moving forward at that time, because there are going to be new board members, and there's going to be, and they can decide how we're going to work our office. But with that in mind, we're still continuing with our specific role as the liaison, and certainly want to be and are always available, you know, to answer the questions that legislators have. And to help guide you in the direction and who to talk to. I think one of the questions that comes up the most in our office is besides, did I say that right? am I calling you the right thing? And after a while you wonder, you don't know. But political correctedness, of course, people want to be politically correct. Don't worry about it so much, we understand. Who do I talk to? So we're there to offer, you know, that that transition for you, to help you out and help you direct you where to go if you want to go visit reservations. You know, we also this year had first of all, I want to say the restructure bill was talked about for years. I was previously, years ago, a legislative director with Chairman Whitefeather, and I'd heard tribal leaders mention, you know, we need to do something about this. I also heard them talk about providing education to legislators. And they would talk about that time and time again. We need to do something to help them out. We need to help, educate them. We all understand about our education system and that we just haven't had a whole lot of education with with regards to the First Nations people. So I had heard them time and time and mention that. And this year we launched the first Legislative 101 training for all legislators, and perhaps some of you were able to take part. We're already beginning to dialogue about Legislative 102, and hopefully we can continue on. And what we want this to be is an outstanding tool for legislators and for everybody, just to give you a little jump start on information that you'll need to know as you're working with tribes in Minnesota. So we do make that commitment. We saw it happen with the help of a whole lot of people rallying around, and hopefully it'll just grow and remain for as long as we can have it. So we did accomplish that in this year. With that said, I hope to answer any questions. You should have. I did forward a copy to the office of our budget. Briefly, our appropriation remains around $475,000. We have a staff of only 4 individuals. We have decreased in size, from my understanding, substantially over the years. So we've gotten to be a smaller office over the years, and we provide the legislative support, the liaison, and now we're going to provide some good, really concrete government-to-government dialogue. But one of the most, I think, critical areas in Indian Affairs Council is our Cultural Resources Department. And when I got to Indian Affairs, I knew very little about that, other than hearing about the reburials, hearing about the repatriation. Having been in, previously I had a sister who worked for the Smithsonian Institute, and having been in the receiving room, just seeing things, you know, hearing about it. But we have a cultural resources director whom I consider, Jim Jones, my colleague, an expert in this area. And I can tell you right now that he does just amazing work, and he has had a wonderful year. So I'm going to turn it over to him. We did have some legislation that went forward in the legislature, but an appropriation that was taken out. I do hope to see, since he is mandated additionally under another statute with the state of Minnesota and does a lot of work with the state archaeologist's office, critical work, that I do hope to see an increase in our agency forthcoming to assist him, because I don't know how he gets it all done himself, truthfully. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to him to tell you a little bit about what he's done, which I think is just a wonderful and fascinating area, and then we'll just open it up for questions and dialogue. So
thank you very much. Senator Lori has a question or a comment prior to hearing from Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Anna Marie. I thought before we got off of the restructure bill, maybe one of the things that you and I talked about a bit during the development of what the bill would look like was the annual summit that it also calls for. Which was a really critical piece. I thought folks might benefit a little bit from hearing about what you expect to see come out of the annual summit then.
Sure. Well, the vision is that the critical issues that we discuss will lead to this annual summit. The annual summit, which will be especially a dialogue that will occur between leadership to leadership. So that will be, and that remains at this time to be defined more as we move into it for the first time.
So that will take place after the new council is constituted.
Yes, and they'll discuss how at that time how we're going to. But the vision is that the dialogue that will be going forward throughout the year, such as what are the most critical issues, Indian child welfare, what are the other critical issues that are coming up, education, etc. That those issues will be and I know there are more major ones will be discussed at that annual summit, leadership to leadership, so tribal leader to governor to leadership. And that's, a big highlight, I should say, of our year and an accomplishment. That's it.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jones, and we will shortly have the copies of the Indian Affairs budget. They didn't make it into the folders, but it's coming presently. Mr. Jones.
Thank you, Chairman, Senator Russ, and members of the committee. when we look at the future of the council and we look at programs, one of the critical areas has been the cultural resource program for the Indian Affairs Council. I have currently been with the council since 1995 and first joined the council back then in January. I think my second day was testifying here at the Capitol in one of the hearings for Senator Langstedt's committee with the Minnesota Department of Transportation. I oversee the protection of burial sites across the state of Minnesota. I oversee the protection of American Indian sites and cemetery sites that relate to American Indian history and culture. I also help to protect and, in cases, rescue remains that have been accidentally unearthed. And that is under Minnesota Statute 307.08, the Private Cemeteries Act, which through the Department of Administration and the State Archaeologist's Office just currently revised that statute as well to clearly define the roles for the Indian Affairs Council and the State Archaeologist when human remains are encountered. As an example, I'd been at a number of sites where in the last month here, human remains were unearthed up in Lake Bemidji on two separate sites on both the west side and east side of Lake Bemidji where human remains had been encountered during development of construction projects, whether it was a home building, construction, all types of methods. Our office is defined under 307 to rescue those remains, and we've been doing so with little or no funding for the Cultural Resource Department for the Indian Affairs Council. I currently oversee the whole state of Minnesota in addition to the state archaeologists. The current state archaeologist's office has two people working under their office. I'm only one. So when we look at the future of the council and we're looking at appropriations or things that we're going to need, that's the area that we're looking at and the support that we can garnish. There was an appropriation for requesting an $80,000 appropriation that did not get made through and was asking for purchasing of a burial site in Becker County. That was a site that we had been dealing with since 2005 that had been unearthed, and we just reburied those remains last Monday, a week ago, and we put over 22 individuals back in the earth. They're closely represented, over 30, I think, that were closely represented from that site. This was a homeowner building a home on the property and had unearthed the remains that we have recently got the date back of 4,600 years old to 4,900 years old. 22 individuals, we had copper artifacts from the site dating back that old. The appropriation was to buy that property and to protect it and list it as a cemetery site. Now, because we did go ahead and put the remains back in the location where they came out of, the site is listed as a state site file now and is now protected. And within the last 2 weeks, myself and a state archaeologist and his staff were on site and defined what the boundaries of the cemetery would be. And the appropriation that was asking for was to purchase that site on behalf and make it part of the state. Currently, under the old legislation, the language was effort should be made by the state to purchase large cemetery sites, and that's where that language came forward. I don't believe that was included on the new language, but it does say efforts may be made. I think we kind of changed that around. The explanation for the governor's veto of it was that we're setting a precedent. I testified at a couple of hearings last year that we currently own two other sites within the state. One is in Red Wing, Minnesota, and the other one is in Beltrami County, where are listed by the state of Minnesota. The Indian Affairs Council is the caretaker of those sites. And I was currently at those sites within the last month because I, again, had brought remains back to those locations and reburied them on that property, on both those properties. The site in Red Wing we have been utilizing for reburial since 1990, 1992. We've been taking remains back to that site and putting them back in the ground there. The reason we do that is so that they're in a protected location, a location that we don't have to worry about them being on Earth in the future. Those are the responsibilities that I oversee for the state of Minnesota through the Indian Affairs Council under that language.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you. Since you didn't have the appropriation to purchase the property, what happened with that landowner who was going to build his home there?
We're currently under discussions about what their next steps are going to be. We're currently looking at the review of the property, because you now have a defined cemetery site located on the property and next to an existing structure that's almost a foundation that's been built there. Whether or not they can flip the plan and continue to proceed with building, or are they going to look at other options of maybe selling it, tearing it down, or coming again in the next year to ask the state to continue to look at an appropriation for purchasing that property. The catch-22, and one of the reasons why some of the language was vetoed, is that was the cause of setting a precedent. And you have a number of landowners that have properties like this that come across remains or find out that they have a burial on the property. Now, not all cases, but a lot of cases, we can work with that landowner and just find an area where they could build and continue to proceed, but avoid the area of the burial site. List that out or have that defined and separated, or create a buffer around that. And that's what we're looking at with the landowner currently at Becker County. We have other landowners who have bought a property, found out they have a burial site on it, and now are waiting to sell that or want to sell that back to the state. And I have a landowner in, I can't remember the name, Pillager, that bought a property a number of years ago, found out there were cemetery sites, burial mounds on the property, and was waiting to hear whether or not the state would buy that property from him. And during last year when we were testifying at one of the hearings for the Becker County appropriation, that landowner called and said, well, what's going on with my property? You know, so it does, in one sense, it would have been setting a precedent, but the precedent had already been set and in place when we bought two other properties under that language. The Red Wing property, I think, is around 11 acres. The other property in Beltrami is around less than five acres, I believe, less than that. I think the total acres for 9 acres on one and less than 2 or 3 on the other. You know, but both of them contain multiple burials. The site in Red Wing contains part of a large burial mound group. The site in Bemidji contains both a historical Ojibwe cemetery, a fur trading post, and burial mounds on the whole property. And the site in Becker County would have included the archaic burials, which would have totaled around 20 to 30 individuals. But that was just a hilltop that had no surface indication of a burial mound or anything of that nature. But they're currently looking at what their next plans are, what their next steps are, whether to proceed with development, proceed with their representative to come forward again with language, or looking at maybe an option of selling it to somebody else. So they're currently under that discussion now. But they do have a defined burial site on their property now. The remains were placed back last week, along with the grave goods that were with them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
I was a bit surprised and disappointed when the governor line item vetoed that part of the bill. It was $80,000 to purchase that property, but it does seem to me that if the owners of the property cannot develop it as intended because it is a burial site, they've probably got some claim against the state and they're going to seek just compensation, and this may cost more than $80,000, you know, in the end if we have to compensate them for not being able to use the land. So I don't know that it was a precedent. I agree. You know, we've already kind of established the policy that we want to identify and protect these burial grounds, but somebody's going to have to pay the cost when that happens. Senator Scoy had the bill here, and as I say, that wasn't the ultimate bill that The bill was signed, but that was a line item vetoed. So I think we're going to be revisiting this issue sooner than later, I would think.
Maybe the issues can be clarified so that the and the more of a discussion of whether doing this is a precedent, and if it is it a well taken one, quite frankly, and maybe further discussions with the governor will come to a better understanding of the whole range of issues, and we can the state can proceed from there. Are there other questions? Did you have other comments that you wanted to make this afternoon?
No.
Okay. That's just any questions or comments for the representatives from the Indian Affairs Council? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I often wonder how you bring these diverse tribes together. I mean, they each are sovereign, and there's big disparities between them now. I represent Shakopee. Obviously, it's very different than Red Lake. And I know that even there's some animosity between them that's rather historic. So how do you decide what issues you're going to bring forward when you have such diversity and disparities between the different tribes?
Well, I think that, again, the council in and of itself, the agency has been in place for so long that there has been working relationships that have developed along the way with each individual tribe. Of course, always at the forefront is the fact that despite the fact that we have one council of all 11 tribes, that in no way should give anybody the indication that we ever tell tribal leadership what to do. It's quite the reverse. The tribal leaders in my tribal leader is my tribal leader, and I hold that very that position of authority very highly, respectfully. I was taught that from my father. Those are your tribal leaders. This is what you do. You know what they say is what you do. So I hold that very near and dear to my heart. We in working, how are we going to get an agreement? The beauty of the situation is it's just like working with the legislature. You're not going to get an agreement from everybody on every issue. And that same philosophy applies to working with all 11 sovereign nations on one board, is that perhaps we aren't going to get everybody to agree, but we may have almost everybody agreeing on the issues that we take up or discuss. Now, within the Indian Affairs Council, again, each tribe is a gaming tribe, and we do not do gaming as a rule. Each tribe handles their own gaming and has their own individuals who are hired to handle the gaming situations. If someone has a question pertaining to gaming, we'll refer them on. But we do not handle that issue. That's as economically diverse as each entity is. We come together in a common history and philosophy and in a great likeness with one another. And that is, and I can speak from personal experience and from personal philosophy and personal belief, and that is I am community oriented. I'm oriented to thinking about you and to thinking about everybody else. And what is best for the individuals that I work for. I don't think on a philosophical basis of what's best for me, which may be in contradiction to a lot of what we see in today's society. I think that I work with a group of individuals who have that overriding philosophy. What is best for our people? We are always engaged on a personal level and on a professional level on what is best for our children. What is best for our elders? What is best for our community? We've been through a lot, as you all know. Senator Rest briefly mentioned that, the history of the state of Minnesota, and we know it hasn't been the greatest, and there have been a lot of atrocities and harms committed to people. But when you have humans living together, that is likely going to be the situation wherever you go, and we're doing a lot of repair. But we do our best to come to a consensus, and we do our best to work on behalf of the people that we serve. And I do believe that we accomplish that. We really do. So it's as similar in a philosophy as working with all of you. You know, we're not all going to agree, but we're going to do our best to come to some sort of agreement. So does that help?
Yes, I understand how we are, Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
Another question. Have you ever undertaken a project, like with another department in the state? I'm particularly thinking of, you know, we've passed the smoking ban, but it isn't going to be applicable on the sovereign lands of the tribes. And yet, I just read a statistic the other day that was rather startling, which says about 60% of Native Americans mm-hmm. smoke.
Yeah.
And could you or would you consider partnering with the Department of Health, perhaps, and putting together a major educational campaign to bring to the tribes and help them understand what we're trying to tell everyone else in the state right now about the dangers of smoke and secondhand smoke and primary
sure.
smoke, too.
Sure. I do know that everybody is very aware of that statistic, and I do believe that statistic is likely accurate, that's a 60% statistic. I was recently approached by individuals who are doing some work on a more of a grassroots level within the community and heightening awareness with regards to the tobacco issue, and I just had a conversation prior to going into this hearing pertaining to that same issue. And it's being approached, I think, on a grassroots level from a very from the position of how an awareness issue, you know, how do we become more aware and on the harmful effects and statistically with regards to the use of tobacco, which differs entirely from the use of any sacred use of tobacco. So this is an entire different area, and diversifying beyond economic development with regards to taking a look at tobacco. So although it is a touchy and precarious situation, you're in effect telling, which might go against the core of every single one of us, telling someone, you know, you can't smoke or you can smoke, you know, people are going to smoke if they choose to smoke. There is some discussion that's going around right now. Again, our direction comes primarily from tribal leadership. So we can engage in these discussions, and we will engage, I believe, more freely in these discussions as we move forward. The issue did come up, I know, in the legislature, and that issue about just enacting the law into the reservations was just, you know, a whole separate issue. But I think the awareness will be heightened. And would we consider? We'll consider anything for the benefit of our people, again. And engaging in any dialogue, which is, I hope, the restructure, and I hope the Department of Health and Human Services, they are all people on our board. So partners.
Mm-hmm. I didn't work for
okay,
it.
Okay, thank you very much. Sure. Very very interesting comments and testimony, and we look forward to having a ongoing relationship under your new structure, and hope that you will continue to visit with Senator Lori in particular if there needs to be any adjustments to the legislation that we pass once you gain some experience with it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we'll hear from the representatives of the Council on Black Minnesotans.
Yes, you do.
I think they've made an agreement.
And members have the 2006 biennial report among their materials. The Council on Black Minnesotans is governed by the statute chapter 3.9225 and was started in 1980. Is that correct in terms of becoming a statutorily authorized group in Minnesota? And it looks like the last time your statute was amended was in 2001. So you're
you're operating under a fairly stable statute in the with regard to your structure and activities. But again, if you all think that there needs to be some changes or improvements, we hope that you will not hesitate to share them with members of this committee. But with that said, welcome to the committee, and if you would identify yourself, please, for the record. We are pleased to have your comments and testimony this afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and other senators that are here, as well as our listening audience, our Human Rights Commissioner and others in the room. My name is Lester Collins. I am the Executive Director of the Council on Black Minnesotans and have almost been with the council for the entirety of its existence. I've been with the council almost 20 years, or 20 years at this particular point. And with me, I also have Roger Banks. I'll let him introduce himself.
Mr. Banks.
My name is Roger Banks. I'm the Policy and Research Analyst for the Council on Black Minnesotans.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Again, Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. Quite honestly, I guess when we first got a call from your office and kind of had a meeting with Peter, and we were somewhat relieved. I mean, often the calls that we get are a little different or have been different than the past. This one seemed like an opportunity, as well as the kind of consultation liaison role that we very much consider to be very important, and the kind of input, I guess, that we really would like to be even more utilized for. Let me first of all say that the Council on Black Minnesotans, as the other agencies, are fairly small agencies. And I think, if I may say so myself, I think my fellow members, and I'm familiar with most of them and probably the least familiar with Mrs. Hill, who I have not worked with as long, the other directors and certainly the directors before those directors, I was very familiar with. And I think we've worked fairly closely together. Having said that, I think I would be a bit remiss also with our human rights commissioner in terms of working with her. We haven't done as much in the last several months as we had in the past, but we do try to work cooperatively among ourselves in terms of strengthening our efforts. What I've given you in your packets, again, is the biennial report. You also have the roster of members. I think there's also an agency initiative piece, but then you have about a six-page report that we've given you and have just discovered that the pages get a little mixed up. I think 3 and 6 are back-to-back, so it may be a little confusing, but you do have all the information that you need. This looks like they're slightly out of sequence, at least what I was looking at, you know, is. So our apologies in that particular regard. Again, the mission and functions of the Council on Black Minnesotans. Basically, as has already been stated, we were created in 1980. And not to carry you through all the functions, I think most of you around the table are fairly familiar, at least with the statutory roles we have. And it is that of liaison with this body, with this legislature, essentially as liaisons to our community. I'm tempted. in some respects, to think that our roles are probably, and I'm certain, are probably even more important today, speaking of the 150th celebration. Mm-hmm. A lot of progress has been, you know, made. There's a lot of work that still yet needs to be done. The growing populations. One of the things that I have, at least among the report that you have, is that our estimated population, and I do mean estimated because each one of the councils has worked with census data and there's some lingering concerns there, even in terms of counts. But it is estimated we're about 218,000 on average, and which is an increase from 2005 of about 27% from the 2000 census. Mm-hmm. So about a 27% increase from 2000 and continuing to grow, I think, as all of you evidently see. I think even the New Americans effort is aimed at growing populations among the various ethnic groups. The African population itself is estimated to be 50,000, and I can guarantee you that it's easily more than that, and especially if you asked any one of those particular groups, Nigerians, Somalians, et cetera, they would certainly argue that those numbers are probably greater than represented, because many of them are hesitant. And I must say to you that trust in terms of government is still yet something, given their experiences where there's issues of, you know, of giving information and identifying who they are. And that's no less the concern even within the African-American community, mm-hmm. but growing, because our various agencies have worked with census bodies in that particular regard.
How much activity does your group undertake with regard to the immigrant community, more, you know, recent immigrants from Africa? Do you reach out to them? And what kind of dialogue do, you know, native Minnesotans have with or native-born people who are born in this country and have grown up here all their lives, and their own families have done the same with more recent immigrants from the African countries?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think a very good question. And I can tell you that quite a bit of contact, concern, and efforts, goodness, dating, I would say 15 years ago, we were blessed, I think, either, you know, with the insight to realize that the so-called native African or African population was projected, and it was part of our projections that the numbers would be as they are, mm-hmm. in fact, perhaps even greater. That has certainly fulfilled itself. We started an effort that, by the way, this body did fund probably 10, 15 years ago, and it was called the African Resource Center. And what we were attempting to do, or what we were attempting to do, in our limited but good-willing attempt, was to create the kind of liaison, partnership, kind of, if you will, some of the hurdles, experiences that African-Americans, individuals born here, things that we've learned to do, access, we were attempting to work with the African community 15, 20 years ago mm-hmm. to strengthen, the relationships between our communities. We decided, quite frankly, that that effort, which yielded much, and in fact, on a more personal, organizational kind of note, I'm now going through our office and kind of revamping, purging, if you will. The problem is that I keep reading stuff from 15, 20 years ago, and the African Resource Center files are about that long in terms of community meetings that we were having with that community over the years. And one of those efforts, by the way, was one for an African liaison, which we still have not, you know, achieved to this day. And that's with the recognition that as well-intended as our efforts and concerns are, I'm still of the mind that, African individuals essentially need to speak, you know, for themselves. Mm-hmm. We are their voice, and we speak, you know, with them. But we were very concerned that to have someone on board and working with the council on a more direct basis is what we were seeking. Having said that, let me just be very careful to point out, we've been blessed, by the way, in that in our existence, that two of our chairs of our boards, one individual has been from Nigeria, and the other one has been from Ethiopia. In fact, not only was he the chair, but he now works as a part of a senior program. He's not funded, you know, with state funds, but through a senior program, and continues to work with the council on the very issue and concern that, you know, that you've just posed to me in terms of how do we improve, strengthen, kind of empower, you know, that population of individuals.
It would seem to me that, you know, having been established in 1980, mm-hmm. Given the social times in that era, that and I may be, you know, way off base, but that a lot of the activity and discussion and so forth would have been dealing with civil rights of people who are already citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And that since that time, the newcomers to our country come here as asylees or refugees, mm-hmm. from untenable political situations in their own countries, and if they weren't experiencing that, we wouldn't have these newcomers. And so it is a matter of welcoming and respecting, but also assimilating people to be successful in this culture, in your culture, in mine, and. And it's a different challenge than it was in the 70s and the 80s. I mean, it might be still be issues of civil rights, but a very, very different from a very different historical viewpoint. And what I'm thinking of right now is the situation that the Liberian community finds themselves in, and I'm sure you're very well aware of that. My own congressman, Keith Ellison, has sponsored a separate bill in Congress, a bill independent of the immigration reform, which is not moving forward at this point, but that would, I don't know all the details of it, but it certainly would relax some of the restrictions that are going to be imposed on the Liberian community that will cause a number of them, not all, mm-hmm. and not obviously not people born in this country, but if they were came here after the political upheaval started, or if they were already here studying or whatever else, they have a different status with regard to the ICE, and they're going. Many of them are going to be asked to leave this country and go back to, if not a political instability, certainly economic instability, and to a country that may or may not be able to provide economic opportunities for them to have jobs. And I wonder what kind of work you are doing with those people. Do you see the Council on Black Minnesotans as in a role of advocacy for the Liberian community, for people to stay here if it means staying with their families, or they want to stay here, or to go back to their original country if they want to do that as well? What do you see your role being, and what kind of conversations do you have with them and with our congressional representatives?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll principally let Mr. Banks speak to the issue. I can only tell you that we have been in discussion, you know, with Congressman Ellison, not only recently, but pretty much
ongoing,
you know, ongoing in that particular regard, and have supplied information. One of the things I should also mention is that my secretary, while not from Liberia, is from Sierra Leone and has worked for the council for about 6 or 7 years. In some respects, she also, in terms of that liaison individual that we kind of talked about not having, She kind of serves also that role because she's involved in a number of different groups. Recently, I don't know, you and Peter both were, well, okay, I'm thinking about the Refugee Day celebration, that, or if you will, that we just took part in at Brian Cole Center, and also the hearing at, what was it?
Again? Washburn.
Washburn. Right. That we attended, but we are working. But I'll let Roger
Mr. Banks.
Speak a little further.
Well, thank you very much. I just might start off by saying that we've historically been involved with all of our congressional representatives, at least from the 5th District, Marty Sabo and Keith Ellison and their staff, in terms of trying to develop some kind of resolution to the temporary status issue that all of the Africans face. In terms of, it's a fragmented picture because the TPS status for Sierra Leoneans, for example, has expired. And what they find themselves faced with is a significant number of them are being deported because they either did not comply or weren't aware of whatever functions that they had to perform in order to remain.
Even though they came here as asylees or refugees?
Yes. And they came under they had temporary status documentation. And so what has happened essentially is that Congress has handled this issue on a piecemeal fashion. The Sierra Leones, the Liberians, Nigerians, the Somalis, Ethiopians, etc. The Somalis got an extension in terms of their STP status. But we still are faced with a significant issue of individuals being deported for one reason or another. And that we've been working and trying to work with organizations, all the national organizations, the African organizations, to, in essence, try to develop solutions to this particular issue. In terms of general outreach regarding African issues, you mentioned that our statute had been amended once, and that amendment was in order to secure the inclusion of representation from African nations. And so that's what we have. We have a representative from East Africa and West Africa. Unfortunately, we don't have representation for the rest of Africa. So in this respect, we have worked with organizations like Stand for Africa. We've worked in terms of the ordinances, police separation ordinances that were passed in both Minneapolis and St. Paul and are currently being considered in Richfield and in St. Louis Park and other municipalities that, for the most part, eliminate the prospects of local officials enforcing civil procedures on the part of the federal government. And so, yes, we have been involved. There's some serious issues that we still have to essentially resolve, and I think Representative Ellison's legislation will go a long way towards addressing those particular issues, at least allowing us to differentiate between the status of individuals and ensure that as few as possible individuals, for bureaucratic reasons, mm-hmm. in many respects, are forced to return back to a situation which is, in many respects, untenable for them.
I know the members of the Liberian community in particular have been a real economic blessing on, particularly for those of us who have had family members in nursing homes.
Yes.
Particularly the women, but the great, caring, compassionate givers of health care that if they had to leave this country and our state, we would sorely miss them and the role that they play in taking care of our family members.
Exactly.
So
Madam.
I hope that they're just speaking on behalf of families in Minnesota, the contribution that they make is just incalculable.
Madam Chair, the same is also true, even in terms of obviously our cab drivers and transportation, and even the controversial issues. You know, there the council's been a part of working with the Airport Commission and with African groups in that particular regard. We also, by the way, as small as our quarters are, have recently, last several months, housed an African group. I think it's the
Safar.
Yeah. And
where are your offices? Where
On University Avenue. The address is actually 2233, kind of University towards 280 University down in that general area. And we've been there, goodness, it has to be 17.
I didn't ask the Council on Indian Affairs where their office
is. I believe that, are they in the Holiday Inn, what used to be the Holiday Inn? Kelly Inn.
They're in the Kelly Inn.
Yeah, right near us here. Yeah.
Anything else you want to take this opportunity to share with us?
I'm going to let Roger, the parts that I would have gone through, and I can tell you deliberately the reason why I always have Roger or some staff. let me clarify. That was just some staff members, though we got two or three others. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. But just to give you some sense of primarily from a public policy standpoint, Roger and I is kind of what you get. I mean, you know, from the standpoint of our office. And we recently, as a part of our budget proposal, we're presently at three staffed individuals. Mm-hmm. That is an office administrative specialist, Roger's a management analyst, myself. And we did have one other individual, and unfortunately, thanks to the governor's proposal, we did get some funding back to, I think it was the 2000, whatever it was, level that we requested. But we're still short of one person. My point is that I trust and appreciate the contribution and resources that he brings, and it also gives me a chance that when I'm talking to what I don't cover, usually he will do very well, and great, what I don't, et cetera. But I'm going to pass on the council's policy involvement kinds of stuff and get more, almost coming full circle around to the new immigrant kind of question that you asked, mm-hmm, and to speak to that more specifically. We kind of agreed that Roger would kind of speak to that. So,
okay. Mr. Banks?
Well, thank you very much. The two particular components of this report that, or the handout that you have that I'll address. The first has to do with the challenges to council operations and effectiveness. And I'd just like to summarize them because they're written out for you. Essentially, the first has to do with the financial, the allocation of the organization. It has just not kept pace with the level of responsibilities that we have experienced over the last, 30 years. And so it's really critical for us to understand that in order for us to be truly effective, given the increase in the populations, particularly the African population, that we are really hard-pressed relative to financial resources. The second has to do with, and you can see in that respect on page 5, the table 1, which sort of delineates our precarious situation over time. The second issue that we're faced with has to do with the gubernatorial appointment process. What we have found essentially is that appointments have not been made in a very timely fashion. And so we were for a long period of time, for at least a year, without a full complement or have a majority of individuals being appointed. And so we've tried to assist the governor and his assistants in this respect. To that degree, for example, under the prior to the Plenty administration, under the Ventura administration, we had developed a particular process that we had gotten permission from the governor and his staff to utilize.
This handout is... Yes. A list of your new members. Is that correct?
Exactly. That's,
and are they gubernatorial appointees? Yeah.
Yes, they are, and with the exception of the legislative representatives.
Well, I was going to just point that out to members. I see that there are In this book, there were four members, and here there's just three new ones. Does that mean that Senator Higgins continues on the council?
This has yet to be determined. When we contacted the Attorney General's office where we get our, you know, the validation, they had not received the information. We have, however, talked to a senator who came to our legislative resource affair on the Hill about maybe 6 months ago, or 5 months ago, that indicated that he was probably going to be the representative from the Senate. And
okay,
so,
well, I see Senator Scheid is on this,
yes,
this list, as well as Representative Mullery and Representative.
Right. We have two senators and two
I would assume that the
representatives.
The second senator will be a member of the Republican caucus. Is that?
Yes.
That's right.
So
right.
You're waiting for that appointment
exactly.
to occur. But these other three have already been appointed, and they're part of your new complement.
Yes.
Right, and seven of those individuals were appointed very recently, I think, at the end of June.
Yeah.
So.
So now you're getting back to full strength.
Exactly.
With a new group.
And one of the critical things about this is, given the nature of the kind of work that the council does, it's not a traditional kind of board. Given the small staff that we have, et cetera, it's more of a very much a working board,
yes,
where they are not only involved in committees, but they're involved in acting as liaison to community institutions, the African American Leadership Council of St. Paul or whatever, in order to fulfill their obligations, so that they serve in a multitude of capacities. And so it's really critical that we have a full complement so that the work load for the individuals will be distributed a lot more equitably.
I understand from the Majority Leader's office that the appointments are Senator Higgins and Senator Han.
Madam Chair, Han, we would not have known until
right
now.
Thank you.
And now you know.
Right.
And thank you very much. But we'll make sure a representative from the Majority Leader's office is here, and we'll make sure that she communicates with you both on who those appointees are from the Senate.
And Madam Chair, speaking of, we still are two individuals down. So if there's anything you could do or folks can do, we just went through
How large is the council?
13 public member board.
And
so
you have how many?
I think it's 11. 11 is the count right now.
Right.
So you're
still
down
two. And I'm not sure that
they go through the regular appointments process,
yes,
right?
Yes.
The open appointments,
yes,
process in terms of making
an application
to the governor.
I'm not 100% sure about why those other two appointments. It sounds like they're going to be made, won't be made for several months, which I don't quite clearly understand, why there has to be that kind of delay. And one of the important things I want to point out is that our last board meeting is the beginning, if you will, you can imagine, of board orientation. And the closer we can get, to everyone being at least of similar understanding, just the better. So
Of the people on this list, since they are the new folks, which of them represent African communities?
I think George.
Ogbonna?
Yes.
Yes. And he's so new that so he does.
Uh-huh.
And Muhammad Noor, who I'm not sure that I'm seeing. I should be seeing, but yeah. Above him.
Yes.
Represents the Somalian.
Understanding that most of the ethnic population, like most of the population, is located in the metropolitan area, and I noticed that with one exception, your membership is also from the Twin Cities area. It appears that Ms. Lampier is from Janesville, which is Greater Minnesota, but Do you look for geographic balance, like from Rochester or Moorhead mm-hmm. or Duluth? And how difficult is it for people to become involved in the Council on Black Minnesotans from different parts of the state?
Madam Chair, again, you can imagine in a 20-year period, I've pretty much seen it all. Uh-huh. We've had individuals from Rochester, St. Cloud, the same past chairman that I told you works for us now was from St. Cloud. We've had Rochester. We haven't had, you know, yeah, we have, been Mankato. We've had, you know, all those areas. And it,
your
it,
statute doesn't require you to have geographic balance. Is that correct?
It doesn't require the balance, but yeah. it's imperative that we have that kind of input, yes.
And it does speak to gender balance. And one of the things that I would like to see us achieve, as you all, I think, can appreciate from a so-called ethnic community standpoint, I think particularly as it relates to so-called Native Africans, I think that it would not hurt to have female representation, you know, from Africa also on a board, because I think it's a whole different kind of perspective, and it's one of the things I would like to encourage, because the thing I want to point out, although we did ask for two additional individuals, that by no way limits, I mean, you know, the number of African appointments. So it's one of the things I would like to see occur or happen. And we're not quite as geographically represented as we have been in the past. So.
Just to mention the second issue area having to affect our effectiveness, and that has to do with the extent to which we are utilizing the resources as a resource by the legislature, by the various administrations, administrative departments at the state level as well. We can act as a very reliable and effective resource source. And so we'd really appreciate the opportunity to have greater dialogue and interaction with policymakers, the legislators, the various department heads. We began this fiscal year essentially with our legislative resource fair on the Hill, where we had the intent, and we invited all legislators, all commissioners, all, you know, individuals who were policymakers within the state government, including the judiciary, so that we might be able to let them know and be able to develop an asset bank that would allow us to more effectively utilize the resources of the African-American for the benefit of the whole state. So.
Madam Chair, I'm a bit concerned because I know our other council. So... because believe me, we could both,
yes.
And particularly, I can
and,
tell
and
you,
this
you
is
could
a,
talk
you know,
to you.
This
you know.
Is, and it's and for everyone. This is a beginning. You know, this is the first year I've chaired this committee in the Senate, and I'm really interested in having an ongoing relationship with the groups that are in the jurisdiction of the committee. And I hope that you will feel free to contact us, Mr. Brickwetty, Ms. Schaefer. Pellinen and certainly myself, Senator Lori, who's a vice chair, and anybody else on the committee, if there are ways in which we can be, develop this ongoing relationship. And I appreciate your sensitivity to making sure that everybody else gets a chance to say their piece, too.
We could definitely jabble on and make many cases, but thank you very much.
Sure. Any comments or questions? Senator Roebling.
Hey, Madam Chair. You mentioned perhaps the need for a position for an African Affairs liaison for the council, mm-hmm. and we also mentioned a little bit the Commission on New Americans, and I know that obviously a working group is going to be looking at this, but I'm wondering what your take on it would be if you could get that sort of representation, and if each of the councils could do the same under the current umbrella that they have, would that be something that would be perhaps close to sufficient, or would it be better to just have a new commission on New Americans?
I'm going to say the answer is very definitely yes. The liaison would be something that we felt that we needed and recognized that we needed, like I said, maybe 10, 15 years ago. I'm even more convinced that we need it now. And I'm going to let Roger speak to the kind of second half of your question in terms of the new, because I think some of our discussion, I thought he captured it, you know, rather well as we sat and discussed our preparation of an answer to that question. So I don't know, you know.
The basis essentially is that, yes, we think that it would be very beneficial to have a commission. But how it's structured is very critical. And that is that the council has a model that it's been using with the gubernatorials, the governor's commission on Martin Luther King, where we have representations from our board, and then we have representations from elsewhere.
You mean in the celebration of the holiday?
The celebration of Martin Luther King's holiday, so that we can then draw on resources throughout the community. It acts as a mechanism to unify resources behind this particular issue, and I think that that's really what is critical. To have an independent entity in and of itself would probably continue to promote the kind of fragmentation that exists already in the African communities. And so we've been working with organizations like Channel Afrique and working with in individual organizations, MIND and the groups up in, and particularly the Sierra Leones and Liberians. In fact, our past president, one of our past board members, Wilfred Harris, was the president of the Liberian Association. And so we've had those kind of relationships in trying to work in terms of trying to resolve these kinds of issues. So what I'm thinking essentially is that we need a mechanism that allows us to consolidate our efforts and to develop collaborations and cooperation between all the particular stakeholders. And so in that sense, we strongly support the development of a commission for this particular purpose and recommend a particular model that allows for adequate and systematic representation of the African groups as well as representatives from the various existing councils.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thank you for sharing your time, and we will stay in touch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Council on Affairs of Chicano Latino People. Let's talk. Mr. Akande. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the committee, and we got a bit of a late start, but we want to hear from everyone. We had intended this committee hearing to be for 2 hours, and we didn't get started on time, so we will take the time to hear everyone's story. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Senators.
Are you going to be using the...
Yes.
The PowerPoint, then maybe we can turn the lights down so that we'll be able to see it. We'll take care of it. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
That's good. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Ricquetti.
My name is Rosa Toc, and I am the Legislative Director of the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. And here with me is today... Oscar Echandi, I will let yourself introduce.
Thank you. My name is Oscar Echandi. I'm the community liaison for the Chicano Latino Affairs Council.
We are here on behalf of our director, Rogelio Munoz, and unfortunately, he was unable to attend this hearing because he's been sick since Friday. And I think that he also sent his apologies. So on his behalf, we would like to talk and present the work that we have been doing with the Chicano Latino Affairs Council in the last year and a half. And also take any questions, comments, or recommendations for the work that we are doing. As you know, the Chicano Latino Affairs Council is one of the four minority ethnic councils that work in the in the state and was established by Minnesota status. This is how the council is composed. We have a board of directors. We have 11 members coming from the community, 8 representing each district, and 3 at large. One senator and 3 members of the House of Representatives.
Who is the senator on your board of directors?
Julie Rosen.
Julie Rosen, and yes. Who are the House members?
You have a list, I guess, in the handouts that we provided to you, but we have Al Junken, Rod Hamilton, and Willie Dominguez.
Oh, yes, I see it. So, how come the House gets 3 people and the Senate only gets 1? How is that fair?
Madam Chair, that's a mystery indeed. I'm afraid I don't know.
We're gonna look into that.
I think that's one question we're gonna that we look can at the statute bring back to you.
That doesn't seem right.
When we consult with the director. And our staff, as the other councils, is very small. The director, we are under his leadership and supervision. We have an administrative assistant, myself acting as a legislative director, and Oscar as a community liaison. It is important to mention that half of the staff, that means Oscar and myself, are pretty new. I started working 2.5 months ago, and Oscar, I guess, 3 months ago. So we are pretty new, and even though we are new in this council, we are very committed and very identified with the work that CLAC has done in the last 30 years. Next year would be CLAC's 30th anniversary, and we are working on providing a celebration of the 30 years of accomplishment, not only of CLAC, but also of the Hispanic Latino community in the state of Minnesota.
And Madam Chair, if I may be so bold to point out, 3 of the 4 staff positions at the Council for Chicano Latino Peoples are immigrants, arrived to America recently. Myself from Costa Rica, I came here in 1998. Rosa from Guatemala, she arrived in
2001.
And Gladys Rodriguez from El Salvador, she arrived here 10 years ago.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So the work we are engaging on right now is that we are taking the experience and the good work that CLAC has done in the past. We believe in the historic institutional memory, and we want to bring back to the community, work with the legislator, work with the governor on issues that are important and that affect the Latino Hispanic community in the state of Minnesota. So that's the work that we want to carry on. We have a mandate, we have a statute, and we are going to be focusing our work in the next 2 years. We recently finished a 2-year strategic plan for working in those to implement and develop these 9 legislative goals. We can summarize them in basically 3 main aspects, which would be to advise, make recommendations, inform and educate the legislator, the governor, and other state agencies, and also the public in general about the issues affecting the community. We are also... We see ourselves, and by the mandate that we have, as an agency which is a conduit to state and provides references and referrals to state access for the Latino organizations for the community as a whole. We also see ourselves as providing a liaison, a relationship, a collaboration with different state agencies and also private organizations, particularly research centers and community-based organizations. Another important part of the work that we will be doing is to perform or try to develop or contract studies with research centers that are specialized on the issues regarding the Latino community, and with that provide more informed and very accurate information about the socio-economical, political, and cultural status of Latinos in the state. And one of our main goals this year, and that we want also to focus on for next year when we celebrate our 30th anniversary, is to publicize the accomplishments of the Latino community in Minnesota. As you know, there's been many generations, and there's been many years that Latin Americans, particularly from Mexico, have come and established themselves in Minnesota. 60% of the Hispanic, Latino, Chicano community in Minnesota is native born. 40% would be immigrants. 60%
are born in the United States, or born in Minnesota.
In Minnesota.
Born in Minnesota.
They are native born.
Very interesting.
Yes. In the last 10, 15 years, there's been an increase in the number of immigrants, and this is a result of the expansion of the Minnesota economy, the opportunities given by the state in many different industries, particularly agricultural services, the third service with restaurants and other hotels, and the meat and poultry plants in southwest Minnesota. So this is a combination of different factors that make that there's been more arrivals coming from other parts of Latin America and Mexico, and also from other states of the nation.
Madam Chair, may I point out to yourself and the committee that these nine legislative goals outlined here are simply a summary of the statute which formed the council, found on page 44 of our biennial report. We simply summarized the nine statutes which we mandated.
And again, your... you were formed in
1978.
Is that correct? And your statute hasn't been changed for over 10 years. I think the last time there was a modification was in 1996. And again, just as with the other groups, I invite you to review the statute and to see if there are opportunities that the council thinks that we ought to take up in modernizing your statute as well. And in some ways, 1996 is not all that long ago, but there's been a great deal of cultural change in our state, and it may well be that you would, in your communities, would appreciate some changes in your statutes as well, and please don't hesitate to contact us about that.
Thank you. We will.
So, as this graphic shows, CLAC wants to be at the center of the Chicano, Latino, Hispanic community. It wants to be at the center as one of the leading experts in providing accurate information regarding the socioeconomic status of Minnesotanos or Latinos in the state. And we want to be providing this sort of accurate information to our different constituents, particularly the governor, the legislators, other state agencies that will require our expertise. And we are looking forward to position ourselves, and this is the vision that we have for the next 2 years. Another important aspect to mention is that we will be working closely also with research centers and with expert leaders who have been in the community for decades, and work very close with them so we can continue updating all the work, all the data, all the information that we have regarding the community. So this is the vision that we have for the future. We are the leading expert, not the only one, not the only one. We are another voice, but we want to be the leading voice in the state regarding the Latino community and impact the state legislative policy and budgeting decisions. So what are the issues we are working on right now? In the last 2 months, I've been in charge of updating social demographic data and all the research that has been done on five different issues. One of them is immigration. Another one that is at the core of the interest of the community, and we also believe that is a strategic issue for the next years and the next decades regarding the accomplishment of the Latino community in Minnesota's education and economic development. And the other two issues that cannot be forgotten and that are part of factoring how the Latino community is going to improve its situation in the next decades is health and housing. So these are the issues that we are studying right now, that we are doing research on, and we believe that the five issues combined in a holistic and in a systemic way will, as a whole, provide us a better idea of how the Latino community is doing, its challenges, and also its assets and contributions to the state of Minnesota. Maybe you're familiar already with this map showing the clusters of the Chicano Latino community in Minnesota. We are trying to update this data, although we will have to wait until the 2010 census to have a better idea of how the population has changed in these particular clusters in the state. As you can see, it shows the density and the importance of the Latinos, particularly in southwest Minnesota and also in the metropolitan area. Then we also have a figure with the percentage of the different nationalities or ethnic groups with which the Latinos identify with. You can see that 66.7% of them have Mexican origin, and then you can see that it is followed by Puerto Ricans, then by Central Americans, Cubans, and South Americans. This is data that we still need to update.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I may point out, these figures are almost 10 years old in terms of demographic data, and they do not take into account the questions of undocumented Minnesotan Hispanics who've arrived in a boom cycle in the last 7 years. Mm-hmm. Estimates from the rural population, as we've been visiting lately, we've just completed a visit to Worthington, we're on our way to Wilmar tomorrow, are almost 30% larger than folks, of course, who haven't signed up for the census. It's
so you need to put this slide on hold for a while
if we
because
could.
It's not accurate.
Thank you.
So when you're asking us to present to the commission what's the kind of work that we have been doing, this is basically what the agency under the leadership of Rogelio Muñoz with his new staff, we have been developing in the last 2 months. And we are very proud of having made a lot of progress during these 2 months regarding a better understanding of the issues affecting the community, a better understanding of how the community as a whole is thriving or is operating or is composed by, and a better understanding of the different programs and the different initiatives that are out there that are trying to also include the Latinos in the state. And some of the accomplishments and some of our goals are to visit the communities in the rural area and gather the voices of the Latinos over there. We've visited Worthington 1 month ago, Tomorrow we are heading for Wilmar, and next month we're going to Moorhead. So this is an important part of the work that we've been doing, and we are also we also co-sponsored the National Conference of State Legislators regarding early childhood education, and last year CLAC contracted a research center in Southwest Minnesota to study and have a better picture of the achievements and also achievements gaps of the Latino students in our public schools. And I think that Oscar would like to add something regarding our community engagement.
If I may, yes. Thank you.
Sure.
We've just begun on a strategic revisioning of our council to begin a biannual process of community visits to the 17 cluster communities you just saw a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Even though we know that a good chunk, almost 70% of Hispanics are here in the metro area, the composition and matrix of Hispanic relationships in the country, particularly Worthington, mm-hmm. is just tremendous. I mean, Worthington is a lively, booming, happy city because essentially, as we just found out, the incoming class of students in the Worthington Public Schools is, for the first time ever, over majority Hispanic over in Worthington.
Senator Vickerman, is Worthington in your district, or whose district is that?
Is it in your district, Worthington?
Senator Vickerman, yep. is that Worthington is in your district, correct?
We have a lot of Latinos, and we love them where I live.
There you go.
And it shows.
It's a very, very powerful statistic to talk indeed. About the children entering the public school system, the numbers that are there.
It is, Madam Chair. Indeed, yesterday I had a conversation with Mr. Rob Anderson, the Wilmer High School principal, who was absolutely adamant about making education a top priority for our policy recommendations. And part of our study here on Latino students in our public schools just keeps showing that a lot of these immigrant kids really are, there's huge educational gaps. And in questions of bilingual teachers, bilingual facilitators, bilingual family liaisons, PTA provisions, even any, for example, Wilmar with a 30% 30% dropout is what they have. They have zero bilingual teachers. Worthington, zero bilingual teachers. And their budget cuts. It's one of my main missions when I interview students. And as I have the privilege of sitting in the Minnesota Department of Education, No Child Left Behind, the dropout prevention program, we're just informing them that the questions of, at least in the rural areas, for these kids to come up to par, they're at least usually 3 or 4 years behind. I mean, it's critical, critical, critical. And I can't stress it enough in this forum to yourselves, in a sense. And I will hopefully continue to advise you, this committee, and as well as all legislators, on this.
You're welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am kind of aware of the time, and I wanted to ask you a question. I didn't know if we were going to have an opportunity to talk about the council's presentations after they finish or not. I think this is such a great opportunity for us to really talk about the opportunities that we have. I know that both Gladys and Rosa and Oscar have met with me to talk about how we can collaborate on specific issues related to immigration and education, and we plan to work together. That's one of the reasons I ask you to please allow me to sit in this hearing. But I feel very strongly that a lot of the work that we need to do with communities of color can be done with the councils, and needs to be done with the councils, because we have several issues that need to be addressed through policy to deal with racial disparities and with gaps in different systems, education, healthcare, and child welfare. I have worked with the councils in the past, but I would like to know if we're going to have that opportunity to have that discussion, because it is so important that that you know that some of us really want to do that and want to figure out how can we do this more effectively in the future. I personally don't feel that we have done this work effectively here, and that not only you don't get the resources to do it, but we don't have a mechanism to do that work effectively for ourselves, for you, and for the communities that you and we represent.
Well, Senator Torres-Ray, I don't think we're going to have the time today to have the kind of in-depth discussion. What I believe we're getting is a taste of what's possible, and it is up to us to follow through on that, and I certainly am, as you know, more than eager to do that with all of the councils as we look to the contributions that they're making to our state and its culture. And this is a beginning meeting, and different from the general kinds of oversight committees meetings that we've had in the past, and that it is an opportunity to get to know one another and to continue that relationship, and that's what I want to do. We do want to hear from the fourth council, and then my staff certainly are going to be in touch with these folks and continue a dialogue and discussion, and everyone is welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This concludes our report. We're especially grateful for your time and your questions, and especially to continue this conversation.
Yes, indeed we will do that. And I would also like to welcome Senator Mua here. And she also is not a member of this committee, but is very interested in the councils of color and their work. Senator Mua, do you have a question or a comment?
Madam Chair, I do, and first of all, let me apologize that I couldn't be here for all of the hearing, because I'm going to ask a question, and I wish that I'd been here to ask the other councils the same question. But I see here on the 9 legislative goals that numbers 1, 2, and 3 is to advise the governor and the legislature on the nature of issues confronting Chicano Latino people in the state, including the unique problems encountered by Chicano Latino migrant agricultural workers. Number 2 is to advise the governor and the legislature on statutes or rules necessary to ensure Chicano Latino people access to benefits and services provided to people in the state. And the number 3 is to recommend to the governor and the legislature legislation to improve the economic and social conditions of Chicano Latino people in this state, numbers 1, 2, and 3. Mm. And I guess I want to ask you a question. Based on your own self-evaluation, how you feel how influential do you feel that you are as a council in achieving numbers 1, 2, and 3, and then how do you measure that effectiveness?
As I was explaining at the very beginning, I've been here only for 2 months and a half, so I was very, very late when the session started and finished. So I still cannot have a benchmark for that. However, the work and the strategic plan that we have and the action plan that we have for the next sessions provide that kind of evaluation and assessment of how influential and how persuasive and how active we will be doing accomplishing those goals. First of all, we will be monitoring the legislation. I've been updating, as I mentioned before, data on the 5 issues that we're going to work on. We are setting priorities with the board so that we establish which are the 2 or 3 main issues that we want to put in the floor and advance in the floor in the legislature. And we are establishing relationships with the legislators. We have talked with Senator Torres-Rey, for example. We have a series of meetings with other legislators. And based also on what CLAC has done in the past and what were the successful issues that they advanced, I think that we can achieve that, and we have a way to assess that in terms of how the legislator and the government can provide fundings and programs and services for the community that we represent.
Madam Chair, may I address
the Certainly. Committee?
Thank you. Senator Tumua, it's an honor to meet you. I've heard so much about you. It's a privilege. When I was glancing through the first few pages of the Indian Affairs Council, I noticed that there was a cultural kind of cultural suggestions for dealing with Indian tribal chiefs, and I hope it would not be inappropriate to kind of offer a certain parallels with dealing with Hispanics. It's messy business. It's joyful messy business, including a lot of soap opera. In the last 6 months, the council has contracted for a strategic revisioning of its process, entire process, everything from operational budget, operational financing, to the way we contract legislators, to the way we started our community visits. The process has been a strategic revisioning. Often is very painful. Rosa and I were hired at the end of that process, and we've begun to try to hit the ground running. And if I may offer you a brief 1-minute explanation of how it's going to happen, we hope it's going to happen. It's like this. My job is to reach out to the community, to the Hispanic community, and try to capture the voice of the Hispanic community, Wilmar, Moorhead, any of the clusters. We schedule a visit, and as we meet with the city officials, both mayor, administrator, restaurant officials, chamber of commerce, folks on the streets, obviously my priority, education, we meet with them individually one day, and then the next day we have a community forum where we invite everybody and all to come and meet with us. In the forum, we discuss the findings of our meetings and try to dialogue with the community, trying to take quantitative and qualitative data. So we have folks voting and folks voicing their opinion. At the end of that visit, we come back to our headquarters here. I'll write up a report, offer those recommendations to the legislative director, and as we write this report from each community, we will condense them into our biannual report offered to the legislature and the governor. Ultimately, of course, what happens to that legislative report? It's simply suggestions. The council is an advisory council. We can't forget that. And so when we offer at the end these suggestions, for example, a very concrete suggestion to me right now is bilingual incentives for bilingual teachers to go to the rural areas. They're starving, and the kids are failing through lack of attention. Very easy suggestion to observe. But what happens with that? I don't know. It comes to the floor and to the debate. How we try to monitor that bill and keep track and in a sense to hope to lobby for that is what we hope to see as the next legislative biennium begins. Whether it's effective or not, as we police ourselves, we continue having a outside consultant come and offers continued feedback and recommendation. The new logos, in fact, and all the presentation has been only in the last month that we've come up with well 2 months I'm sorry that we've come up with these. Presentations. We hope, and the executive director is particularly pleased that a lot of the dysfunctions of the past can get through, and we can get very good, concrete, effective suggestions for this very, very large and growing constituency to yourself and the other senators, as well as some good, concrete suggestions for Palenti, which would translate to legislative action. Is that helpful?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. We very appreciate welcome. Your being here today, and we will now invite Ms. Herr from Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans to address us. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share with you a little bit about the council and then to take this opportunity in the spirit in which it was given, an opportunity to work with you all and to set some expectations of one another as to how we can work with each other in reaching and serving the Asian Pacific community, the community that I'm charged to work with. So, we are a state agency, and our mission is threefold. You can go back to the last one. To start off with, let me just take a step back. My name is Eileen Herr. I just assume that a lot of you know me. I've worked with you individually and have appeared in front of you in several other committees. But my name is Eileen Herr, and I am the executive director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans. And I've been in this position for the past 9 years, so I've seen a lot of things. I believe I'm very fortunate. I've been able to see so much of Asian American history happening and unfolding in the state of Minnesota and been very, very grateful to be a part of it. But as you know, the Asian Council was the last of the councils to be created in 1985, and our mission is to be an advisor to policymakers, advocate for the community, and builder of bridges. And I am sharing with you four pieces of information. One is just a brief summation of our biennium report, my PowerPoint presentation, a national report that we are a part of, a community of contrast, in which we wrote up and provided the demographics for the Twin Cities Metropolitan Asian Pacific Community and made recommendation as to how to address some of the issues that are brought up in here. And then a clarity of purpose, which is the council's strategic plan that the board adopted in August of 2004, and we're in our third year of implementation. So that this mission statement is not part of our creation, but actually it is a blend. If you turn to in your strategic plan, page 7, the centerfold here. This top sheet here is actually our 14 mandates that is in our statutes of things that we should do. And from that, we group them into three broad categories of these three mission statements. One is to be advisor to policymaker, two, advocate and work for the community, and three, to be a bridge between communities, Asian and non-Asian, Pacific Islander and non-Pacific Islander. So with all of this, the board took a hard look at exactly what Senator Moore asked. If we are to be advisor to policymaker, what does that mean? How do we measure that? And when do we know that we've been successful? If we say we're advisor to the legislature, how do we advise? Who do we advise? Do we advise you as a body? Do we advise you as individuals? In the past, we've done both. When the majority leader needed advice, we would go to him and sit with him and talk to him. But that's always been case per case. And then whenever individual legislators needed us to work on a specific issue, we've worked more. So as much as we would like to work with all senators and all, you know, House members, sometimes it's not possible. And an idea that I had with Peter as we were planning this is that come to understanding with leadership as to what are some top priorities that you all would like to accomplish with regards to the community, and have the councils be a part of making that happen. So, you know, we did a hard assessment in looking at ourselves, and we came up with some goals and some priorities. And we, like I said, we're in our third year of implementation. One of the things that we know that we're not very effective in is the part of the advice, in that we can give advice, particularly to, as the administration changes, and I'll be very blunt, working with this governor has been very, very hard, in that the advice that, one, he's not wanted advice from us, and two, on issues that he's wanted advice, we've not been able to give him the advice that he wants, and that is because of the second part, is that we want to be an advocate and work for the community and the community voice. An example of this is the racial profiling. When it came down to the end of the line, we did not go with the administration point because the community wanted a racial profiling study and the administration didn't. And all the councils, we pulled back from that discussion, and that upset the administration really pretty much to the point where they were thinking about cutting our funding at some level. But we were adamant in that the community says there is racial profiling. They want to understand it. They want the state to fund a racial profiling study statewide. And that was the position that we took. It was very controversial with the administration. But again, like I said, we want to be grounded in the community. We want to be relevant. We want to be real with the community. And so that's the second part, is that when we advocate and work for the community, I'll be the first to say we are not as effective as we want to be, because the Asian Pacific community in and of itself is not one ethnic group that speaks one language, that all came at the same time with the same understanding of the political structure or the same embracing of the pan-Asian American identity. I think for the most part, if you talk to an Asian person, I would call them an Asian person. If you talk to someone who looks like me on the street and you ask them, what is your ethnicity, or are you Pacific Asian American? They would answer, yes, but at the same time, I'm Chinese American, I'm Asian Indian American, I'm Hmong American. So that whole concept of working with the community, going out to the community, having trust and credibility with the community is a hard and long road in which we have to establish trust and credibility with one another. There has to be opportunity to work with one another, opportunity to see realistic results. And so what I tell my staff and I is that when we work with the community, let's be tangible. Let's do things that can produce results so that the community can see that, yes, they have a voice, we can work together, and we can get some results. So we want to be an effective advocate for the community. But in the state of Minnesota, there's about 200,000 Asian Pacific Islanders calling Minnesota their home. Out of that, about 80% live in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, and then the rest live in greater Minnesota. And we've done the best that we can to go out into outreach to them, and I think we've built some really strong alliances and relationship. But then there are certain pockets that we've not been able to effectively work with. For example, there's a nice community in Duluth, but the community there is not as organized as the community here in Minnesota. So for us to go and work with them, it's been kind of hard because we work with individuals, but they don't have an Asian American group that comes together and work and do things. So we try to support them as much as we can, particularly in education and issues involving crime and workplace economic security. The third one is to be a builder of bridges between different communities, and this is where we really take to heart that we want to highlight, celebrate the contribution of Asian Pacific Americans, and that's why I'm really glad that next year during Statehood Day, May 11th, falls in Asian Pacific American Heritage Month, and in Asian Pacific Heritage Month, we always host a huge annual dinner in which about 500 Asian and Pacific Islander community members come and gather and convene in a dinner format and meet, and so we can definitely fold that in. And we, again, like I said, are a state agency, and we're very, very proud that we are a state agency. Because when I talk to my other colleagues, and right now I'm working with a group of Asian Pacific Americans in the state of Wisconsin to help them think about forming an Asian Pacific Council in Wisconsin, because they see how we're set up and how we work and the institutional voice. They want to see that happen in the state of Wisconsin. And so we've been working with them. I worked with the Asian Pacific community in the state of Georgia to help them actually pass legislation that created an Asian Pacific Council in the state of Georgia. And so when they look at Minnesota and the things that you do, you know, you Google it and they find us and they want to know how can we do it and what are the things that you're doing. So as a resource state, nationwide, we've been there and we've tried to do as much as we can. But at the same time, I do like to focus our attention to the state of Minnesota. We are a state agency. We're funded to do statewide work, and we want to keep that as our main focus. As part of Heritage Month, we also are involved in creating pan-Asian identity and efforts. So we've been very instrumental in visioning and seeding the Asian Pacific Cultural Center, in which the legislature gave some funding to in the last bonding year to do planning. And that is the concept of building a center that would house or that would be the home of knowledge and information about the various Asian ethnic group and cultures within the state of Minnesota, and using that as a resource to teach and to outreach to others and teach them about the Asian Pacific community. Another big endeavor that we help to start and to continue to support is the Dragon Festival, which just happened on this Sunday, Saturday and Sunday on Lake Phelan. And I saw the majority leader there with his children enjoying the wonderful day at the lake and the dragon boat race. So there's many, many different things that that we do that we're trying to And we try not to be pigeonholed into these three broad categories. But at the same time, we want to be focused. We want to be able to see results, and we want the community to have a clear identification of who and what we are. So I have a long presentation, but I'm going to stop there. I really want this to be interactive, and I know you have questions. All afternoon you've had questions, so I want to give ample time for you to for you and I to have a discussion about the issues that are important to you. Thank you.
Your comments. Senator Moore.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Hurd, thank you for your presentation. I see here that the council is supposed to have 23 members. Are you operating at a full complement of board members?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore, no, we are not. Currently, we have 15 board members, but six of them were actually just appointed in the last month by the governor. So I share the same frustration as the Council on Black Minnesotans in that the appointment process with the governor's office has tended to be slow, much slower than it was under Ventura. This session, we had six because of the last 3 years we've not had appointments. Or one or trickle of one appointment per year, and so we've not been operating at full capacity. It's also a challenge for me, too, to find board members from outstate because they have to travel into where we have meetings. We've tried to have meetings once in St. Cloud, but that took a lot of organizing board members to get there. So we do now have 15 out of 19 board members, and by statute, representing different ethnicities within the Asian Pacific Islander ethnic communities.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Ms. Herr, I understand that in some way the requirement that not more than one member on the board come from each of the ethnic communities, and I'm wondering if that's posed as a challenge to the council in terms of recruitment of board members and appointee of board members. And I'm wondering if the council has any thoughts or ideas on perhaps revisiting that specific provision so that the board could be operating at a full complement.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Moore, we have looked at that. That's in 1996 was when the council significantly changed its statutes, its statute. Before that, there was no limitation on ethnic groups. There are 42 different Asian ethnic groups in the state of Minnesota right now, according to the state demographer. It is, as much as we would like 42 different ethnic community members, we just know that logistically that's going to pose a big problem. So the board, at the time of restructuring, similar to what Council on Indian Affairs did last year, they looked at what would make the most sense, and they came up with the number 19, that would be manageable each person. So when they changed that about 10 years ago, they did look at it. Before that, it wasn't ethnicity-driven so that you could have as many as you wanted. And I think the board at that time really struggled in saying that if there were 10 positions and 7 of them were just very enthusiastic Chinese community members who got on the board, would that then make it one way to focusing on the needs of the Chinese American community versus the other Asian Pacific communities? So the board did look at that, and we have been looking at this issue because I think Representative Tao came up with some really good ideas on how the board could be positioned. And so the board have talked about it for the last couple of years. And I think the board members have always said and remained strong to the point that even though they do come from different Asian ethnicity, they, when they come to the board, they represent the Asian Pacific American identity. And so that's one of the hurdles, in that when you come on, you have to put the good of the Asian Pacific community foremost before the need of your own ethnic group. And that's something that has sort of not cause tension, but we've always asked board members that when you speak about this, are you advocating for your own Asian ethnic group, or are you putting on the hat of the whole Asian Pacific community? What is the common good? What is the greater good? So we have looked at that. We have talked about it, particularly at the board level, and I think they are pleased and satisfied with the way that our statute is. Should they decide to change, they know that they have advocates and they have friends in, and that we have friends in the House and the Senate that can help us to improve and to change our statutes.
Last question, Madam Chair.
Senator Moore.
Ms. Herr, how is the, what is the process to fill the vacancies?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Moore, the process really is within the governor's office and the Secretary of State. It goes through the appointment process. It is a political appointment. We, as much as when we're notified that there is a when there is an open appointment position, we let the community know. But then we also let them know which position is already filled, too. Like right now, we have a Pakistani, Asian, Indian. So we let them know. Like right now, we have that are not represented. The ethnicities are Lao, Burmese, the Karen community. So we let them know which one is already ethnicity group that we have already. And so then it opens and we let people know and we try to outreach as much as we can. But we don't receive the applications. It goes straight to the Secretary of State's office. And from there, then it goes to the governor's office in which he has an appointment person who looks through that. And most of the time, we don't even get called in until the last minute when they've already made a slate of people that they're going to pass on to the governor and that they've interviewed, they've called, they've done the background check, and then they set us down and they ask us, do you know these people? And we're like, well, we know them, we don't know them, but it's really at their discretion even to have that type of meeting with us or not. Sometimes they do it as a courtesy. I know that when John Burns was running the appointments, he did call us in. But even if we knew or didn't know the person, he would pass it on to the governor to look at already. So the whole appointment process, and I actually prefer it that way because then it's blinded to us and it doesn't show favoritism or it doesn't show networking on our part, and it is a political process. They could try to influence the governor's office as much as they can with regards to the appointment process, but with regards to lobbying the staff or the board members, you know, we try to stay out of it as much as we can to be neutral and to have opportunities for the community.
Okay, thank you very much. This has been, thank all of you. It's been a really interesting hearing and interesting discussion, and again, as I said earlier, it's a new beginning for us, and we hope to keep up this dialogue and to get to learn more about your work and ways in which the legislature and the administration can be supportive and good listeners.
Great. Thank you so much.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam
Chair.
Last
question.
I didn't get to ask this of one of the councils, but I was wondering about the idea of the New American Commission on New Americans, and whether or not you felt that would be a major asset, or would it be better to have a department like that under your council for groups coming from Pacific Asian communities.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, when I think of New Americans, I know that they are not just within the four
councils.
They are from Russia. They are white Canadians that choose to make Minnesota, the U.S., their home, Canada, Australia. So when I think of New Americans, I really think of the full spectrum. So we only serve part of those New Americans. And so I'm glad for the commission. I'm glad that they will be looking at all New Americans, because I did have a meeting once, maybe 3 years ago, with a wonderful Ukrainian gentleman who met me and heard about the council and how it was so great and how he wanted should we have a council on Ukrainians? And I said, you know what? In Minnesota, anything's possible. Go and talk to some legislators. I've got some good friends here. Go talk to them, present your ideas, and see what happens. And I would like to think that this commission on new Americans is a result of a lot of those thinking that here are some great assets. When we come to America, there are things that we need to know. And we don't necessarily fall in with four of the councils of color or the minority councils. And we need someone to be our voice. And I'm glad that that commission will be looking at what are the benefits and what can Minnesotans do to support and make new Americans successful. And the more people that we can help us to do this work, the better off we all are. So I'm really glad for that idea. And we know that we're listed as one of the partners and providing support and information to the Legislative Commission as they work and staff and work with new Americans. So we will definitely bring people to that table, but knowing that that work is larger and broader than what we each have in terms of our purview.
Thank you. Thank you again very much, and it was a wonderful way to end the hearing. There being no further business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Good job. Thank you.
So you're going to...
Yeah. Yep.
So you're coming out to my district.
Coming out to my district.
Any members who are not here,
yeah, we're going to, we're not going to do it.